Friday Night Racing.
On Off the Ball.
And they're off.
Brought to you by Go Racing. Plan your day at the races at goracing.ie.
Yes, you're very welcome along to this week's Friday Night Racing. And it's a very special, unusual Friday Night Racing because Johnny Ward is here with us coming off the back of a winner. Johnny, how are you? Stunned.
Wow. Yeah, good form, yeah.
Yeah.
Get nice warm weather.
It's great.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of... It's the Irish weather where you're outside, it's sunny and you're getting rained on at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. But, it's... we might have a bit of a summer anyway. And some great... You know, when you look at Royal Ascot... They've been absolutely lashed on there some of the days, so I think we're not getting it too badly, to be fair.
A reminder, Friday Night Racing is brought to you by GoRacing.ie. You did go racing during the week. You won with a horse that you've owned for a year, and that horse is gone. What happens? Explain this whole thing to me.
Yeah, funny thing, the name of the horse is Sabras, so I got him out of a claimer 12 months ago in Sligo.
What's a claimer?
So... Claimer's interesting. They run these races a lot in the States. Not so much over here, but they're becoming more popular. So usually in a race, if it's a handicap, the weight that the horse carries is dictated by how good the horse is, basically based on his form. So a horse might be rated 59, so then he'll get 4 pounds in weight off a horse rated 63. And so it's a pound per rating or whatever. But in a claimer, the weight that the horse carries is dictated by what price the connection's put on the horse. So... Sabras was put in the Sligo claimer last year for €4,000. So you could claim him after the race for €4,000, or at least you could make a bid for him for €4,000. And if there were three claims last year, and I was one of them, so I got the horse anyway. This year I put him in for €4,000, and if you wanted him, you could again bid for him for €4,000, but he would be getting weight off horses that were put in at, say, €6,000. So they cost more in theory because they're better or whatever. So Noel Kelly, the Derry trainer, he put in the only claim, possibly the only claim in the entire race, so no other horse claimed. And Sabras won, and he was claimed by Noel Kelly, and... As of the following morning, he woke up in a new stable in County Derry, in a new jurisdiction even.
Right. That's mad. And so when you were one of three bidders last year, does that mean your bid was the biggest?
Or no, so a seller works a bit like what you're saying, but a claimer is the exact price, so it's just potluck. I think I had two trainers putting in claims on my behalf last year. And one other claim for somebody else put in another claim, but Gavin Cromwell got him. And in fairness, it was a good story about why claimers can be quite valuable. He ran his first nine races since I got him. He was in the money every time, and he won two of them. And his last race for me, he won €6,500, and he was claimed for €4,000. So there was like over €10,000 coming minus deductions from that race. And funnily enough, the prize money was basically the same as it was for a race in Leopardstown last Thursday that he ran in. That was like you're talking Premier League against non-league in terms of how hard it was. So the claimer worked out to be a far better option. Ultimately, he got claimed, but best of luck to new connections.
So if you wanted to keep the horse, though, you wouldn't put him in a claimer because...
Yeah, you're open to... If you put him in a claimer, it's out of your control. You know, you can try to claim him back, and usually that will work. Like, if you looked at the likes of Yufton this season that Johnny Fien got for... Like, he was a very good horse. I think he got him for about €7,000 or €8,000. And he ran him in claimers in Dundalk. And he basically paid for himself straight away. Now, the flip side of that is somebody could claim him. But such as, you know, that's the way it goes. A lot of these claimers are not very competitive because of that risk that you don't really want to run a horse that you're willing to get rid of.
Yeah, and sorry, just explain that to me again. If there are multiple people claiming the same horse, it's a lottery, is it?
It's just a lottery, yeah.
Okay, right.
Like life itself, I suppose.
But
no,
in
fairness to the horse, he... He looked like he was, you know, an absolute world beater in Sligo, but Sligo Racecourse sent me a kind of a paper-framed photo of him with a beautiful Ben Bulbin in the background, which I received this morning. And a lot of people could argue that racecourses, they don't look after owners as well as they should. But I thought that was a lovely touch from Sligo. And they also presented me with this kind of... like a trophy that had a sculpture of, I think, the Sligo races on it in kind of artistic form. So it was they definitely looked after a winning owner, and that actually does mean a lot because most owners don't win, and when you have a winner, you like to enjoy it.
Yeah, no, fair enough. All right, well, hopefully you'll pick a winner for us as well, and we obviously wish Sabras the best. the best of luck in the future.
Yeah, as he begins. And it was just another indication of perseverance in life. And Jonjo Bright will certainly be talking about perseverance. It was his 31st start on turf, and he'd never won on turf before.
Right.
And so he finally got there.
There you go. You mentioned Jonjo Bright. It's time for us to bring in our special guest this week. It is Jonjo Bright, who knows a thing or two about selling horses, it turns out. Jonjo, good afternoon to you. How are you doing?
Hello, man. How are we going?
Yeah, pretty good. So you were involved in the sale of, I think if I'm right in saying, the first horse that you've pinhooked just recently. If I haven't got any of the details right, then you might correct them for us, but it sounds like a pretty exciting story. You bought a horse for a price and you sold it for more. Hey, presto, you're in business.
Indeed, indeed. The simple terms of business. That's my first one. I've been trying there now to buy two foals every year. And so in my case here now, I keep them through to their 3-year-olds, and the gamble there is getting them back to the sales now, healthy and correct, and getting them on to the next man.
So talk us about the one. There was a sale recently at Goff's a couple of weeks ago. Was that the first one that you'd successfully brought through from foal to 3-year-olds?
Yeah, that's the first one of my first two. The other one there, I'm going to hold on to, just for a number of reasons. I weighed it up and I thought he probably through the ring he wouldn't make enough, and I quite like him, so I'm going to hold on to him and take a chance and a point to point with him.
Okay, right. So will you be training him at that stage as well, or do you put him for somebody else to train?
Yeah, no, I'll put him into somebody else there, and we'll leave every man to their own job.
Yeah, okay. So fair enough. Talk to us a little bit about pinhooking then, because we haven't really talked to too many pinhookers on the show before. What is it?
Well, I suppose, in terms of national hunt animals, I'd be looking to buy them usually about November, December time off the breeders. And I'll keep them through, or as some boys would talk about, store them through until they're 3-year-olds. And then the challenge is then getting them back into your desired sales or sell them privately to the next man then who may well be wanting to keep that horse for his whole racing career, or what's getting more and more common now, point to point men or even boys to run in bumpers.
Are these exclusively national hunt horses that you're dealing with at the minute?
At the minute, yeah. The flat game would be a whole other. My knowledge on any of this is brave and limited yet, but certainly on the flat, I'd have a lot to learn yet, but. That could be something for the future.
Just on the national hunt horse, so Jonjo, you're looking for to buy low, sell high. But what do you do as somebody starting out? Do you go for a pedigree that people aren't gone on? Do you you have to take a chance because you don't have a limited amount of funds? So how do you buy low and sell high?
Well, firstly, I'm lucky there. I've had a nice bit of help picking them there from Ian Ferguson, who's probably as good a judge at buying a foal as you'll get. I quite like a young sire there. For example, with my first two there, it has worked both ways. Fame and Glory, obviously, when he went on, by the time he had runners, he's got very, very popular. Boys can't get enough of them, whereas Imperial Monarch kind of went the other way. And that was one of the main reasons why I decided to keep that boy, because I actually really like him, maybe by next year they might have completely turned and they'll be fashionable again. But a young sire is something I like. I suppose it's the ultimate gamble, but when it works, it just shows you there it's nice.
What do you look at when we see a foal? I suppose we see a very cute little animal,
bandy legs,
looking for the love of his mother. But in terms of actual physical confirmation, what would Ian advise you to look for, and what do you look for, Jonjo?
Well, that's what I'm still trying to pick up all the time. But one thing would be, like the likes of that Fame and Glory horse, he had nice big, he had nice big joints. He had big bits of a frame that, you can imagine that foal, he's going to grow into that, and he's going to grow into an animal with plenty of bone about him. And he could always walk. That's something that I suppose they can either do or they can't. And he would have he was a real head turner as far as moving and walking goes, you know.
Can you take us back to the first day that you went to actually buy your first two foals? What level of excitement are you at? How nervous are you? What's the bidding like? That whole process, I think, is just fascinating for people who don't really understand it or have never been through it.
Yeah, well, I suppose it's, you know, from a farming background, the idea of the auction is something I was always used to. The actual bidding, you know, and in this case, you know, I let other people do that for me. But no, it was the first day I went down. You know, I think it would be a dangerous mindset to go to the sales, thinking I'm definitely coming home with my two new recruits. Because you don't know what way price is going to be. You don't know what sort of sale it's going to be. So it's just kind of keeping an open mind. And if there's something there that fits your job, well then it's have a go at it, you know.
And when you were successful the first time, what was that like?
I didn't think that fame and glory fall. I didn't think I would have got him. I thought he would have made too much, you know. That's the other thing. I think, especially starting off, you need to have a, you know, set a budget in your head and try and stick to it, because when you get in that atmosphere, it would be very, very easy to get carried away and, you know, that could be disastrous.
Yeah,
there are parallels with betting here in that, you know, you go to the races, you fancy a horse and you're expecting 4-1 or whatever, sort of 7-2, 3-1, 7-2, 3-1, 11-4, and then you start thinking, I really want to back this horse, but if John Joe wanted to spend 8 grand, there's not much point spending 12.
Yeah.
Have a figure in your head, and if you want to go a bid over that or something like that, well, so be it, but, you know, try and stick to that.
Yeah. Like, the strategy of all that is hugely important. But then the other part that's, like, really fascinating is you've kind of blah, blah, blah away. So I bought it here and then I stored it for 2 years and then I sold it again. But what's the skill of those 2 years? Like, that's, you know, that's living with this horse every day, taking it from a foal who can't do anything to a position where you can actually then sell it to somebody who thinks they can turn that into a future champion. So what are you doing with the horses? How does that living with the animal actually work?
Well, I have tried to set up as easy care a system as possible. I put in, for example, barriers, you know, that we can literally just set in the winter time. We can set their hay in front of them. Just have everything as handy as possible. And the main thing is safe. You know, you don't want to be, you know, when you're splashing out rightly in these foals, you know, you don't want to be. You want to minimise the risk as much as possible, because, as I say, that is the gamble, getting them back to the sales healthy and correct. Aside from that, you know, you're wanting to keep them well wormed, keep them healthy, and in the summertime there, that's you know, plenty of the good green stuff, I think, is, you know, in this country, that's our main advantage, you know. The grass there to put a bit of condition on them and keep them healthy.
And what work do you do with them? Like, when do you put a saddle on them for the first time? What's that process?
So these horses are sold as stores, so they're sold unbroken. So there'll be no saddle, but maybe the last 6 weeks or 2 months they'll get what's known as sales prep. So between my fiance Rhea and my dad, John, he got. That first horse he got well done now. There'd be a bit of lunging, a bit of work on the walker, tying his head down, just getting him prepared for the next man now who's gonna back him and then probably throw him out then for a couple of weeks.
Right. Okay. So you're getting the horse from a foal and making sure that they're safe and well for that 2 years. You have them for a very short period of time in their overall life, but it's obviously hugely important.
Yeah, and trying, you know, I like to think they're, you know, I have a bit of ground that they go to in the summertime, and they go away from, you know, they're checked every day, but they're away from everybody. They can get their head charred, you know. They're gonna have their whole racing career they'll be with people every day there. And I like the idea of getting them away. Let them have a, you know, get their head showered before they start, you know.
Yeah.
Do you get affectionate towards them as well when you have them so long from, I suppose, baby?
No, I don't. I don't. That wouldn't be in my nature.
You're a ruthless man, John Joe.
I don't know. Are you sure you kept one because you liked him?
No. I like him. I like the way he moves, and I like. No, but you know, whenever you set out to do this, you know, it's a business. You know, but in saying that, you know, I would take as much joy out of seeing a horse that we have stored here go on and do something special for somebody else as I would holding on to him. And, you know, if he was to be running my colours, it would take every bit as much joy out of that, you know.
So you've got, you've been buying two every year for the last couple of years. How many have you got with you at home in storage, so to speak?
Well, that would have been six, you know, so we're down to five now, and then we'll go down hopefully in November again and go again. I would rather stick to two and try and keep the bar high now, try and be buying exactly what I want every time,
yeah,
rather than, you know, putting numbers away up and try and keep the thing sort of quality rather than quantity, you know.
The other five, apart from the Imperial Monarch, what have you?
I have a Sageburg yearling, a Valoran yearling, a Mallor 2-year-old and a Frozen Fire 2-year-old.
So a nice mix and match there in terms of stallions and fashionable ones and maybe slightly less fashionable.
Yeah, indeed. The Frozen Fire, I'd say he probably needs a good horse now. Mm. He's going to turn into a gorgeous model of a horse, which is going to stand by him. The Valoran yearling is the one I really like. A real active wee pedigree. And Valoran is in the sales ring. He's been very popular this year so far now.
John Joe, how's your health at the minute? People might not be familiar with the fact that you had a fairly significant accident in 2013. How are you getting on at the minute?
Brilliant. Yeah, I can't complain. I'm very lucky there. I always say it, but the Irish Injured Jockeys, they put me in the best possible position to stay in good shape and maintain that. Like today there, I'm just back from a physio session, which is, you know, for a couple of hours afterwards, it's hard on me, but, you know, I do that 3 days a week, and I use the exoskeleton, which is, I probably take it for granted now a wee bit, but I don't think I could do without it now.
Tell us a bit about what is the exoskeleton, because a lot of people won't be, again, familiar with the whole notion of it. It's an external frame that you kind of sit into, is it?
So it's basically like a wearable robot is a good way to describe it, which allows me to stand and walk. I mean, I would do maybe 2,000 steps a week or more sometimes. Now, that's maybe not a lot for somebody who records their steps throughout the day, but that's 2,000 steps for somebody who shouldn't be out of the chair at all.
That's incredible. I'm amazed at that.
Yeah, no, it really does the work of probably five or six physiotherapists, and it's all based around the idea. The exo and the physio that I do as well is all based around the idea that your body's not designed to sit down all day long.
Mm.
So I heard a good
go on, yeah.
I heard a good saying the other day there. If I rest, I rust.
Mm. Actually, that just for the people in desk jobs, you know, and I've spoken to physios about this, John Joe, in terms of people who need hip replacements and that, and because if you go to the Middle East, you go to Japan, and they eat on the floor. Our posture, we're just not able to do that unless you're doing some sort of activity, because we're not used to that. We sit down so much that we're actually, I think we're really, as you say, rusting, John Joe. We're not doing enough activities in other ways.
Indeed, yeah. Activity is you know, like even just in terms of being at the sales there for 3 days, and you know, other people maybe being at the sales would be tired there from all the moving about and so much walking. Whereas it's the inactivity that I noticed. You know, literally sitting in one place for 3 days, it was hard on me. Like, and I'm still, you know, like this week's physio there, I'm literally caught, you know, battling against that. Which is, that is the reality at the minute. It's a constant battle to keep my body maintained and keep it in good shape and stay fit. And at the minute, you know, that is working. You know, I am in good shape and I'm happy with that, you know.
What age are you now?
I'm 25.
25. So you were this, it was 2013 the accident happened, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Torella point to point, yeah.
Yeah, such a blow to someone so young, and I was always impressed with your positive attitude coming out of it, and that of obviously John Thomas McNamara, because he got injured around the same time, and despite the fact obviously it didn't end well for him, he was never downbeat about it despite his prognosis and all that.
Yeah, I mean them sorts of scenarios, it's amazing. You know, like I watch things about other people who have had unfortunate circumstances, and I think that's, you know, how do they deal with that, and it's amazing. But it is funny when you're in a situation like that, what is your other option? You might be down about it for, you know, the meantime, but you begin to think then, what's the best way around this, and what's the best way, you know, to structure things to move forward and try. And a big thing that I suppose I've done and everybody around me too is we try and keep things as normal as possible, which for me was when I was in hospital, like the nurses and the staff, they were absolutely phenomenal, you know, obviously, but sometimes I think they're, you know, they can try and mould you maybe into thinking that you're made of glass, sort of. And as soon as I got out of hospital, that was one thing I wanted to change. You know, I got back to doing as many of the things that I used to do as possible. And I mean, now today, like I'm at the minute there, like I'm flat out. Like I couldn't fit any more into my day, really. You know.
Yeah, I'd say you're the position you're in now compared to maybe how it looked 5 or 6 years ago is definitely the outlier of a positive outcome because of how active you are and doing that many steps in a week, 2,000 steps in a week, which is a lot more than people with more able means.
Yeah, but as I say, like I'm extremely lucky, and I never forget that to be put in that position. You know, there's many people with an injury like this that knows that that's the right way to do it, but it's just, you know, it's just harder for them to structure something like that, you know.
I think it's a great thing about racing as well, Ger, is that you know, if you're not, most people aren't jockeys in racing, so there are stable staff, there are trainers, there are this and that, and you found a role that you seem to be enjoying as well.
Yeah, well, from early on, I did see this as a way that I can still be involved in racing, without obviously, basically with minimal physical input. Obviously, I get a hand, you know, in terms of, you know, looking after and stuff. But no, I'm enjoying it, and I do see, you know, a future in it. Obviously, that could be beginner's luck, and they might not all just go the way this boy did, but. Hopefully, fingers crossed, you know, it's something that I can keep at and keep building on knowledge, you know.
How much of your accident do you actually remember? Is that something that you've thought about since? Is it something that kind of you live with on a daily basis, or did you manage to put that behind you completely?
No, well, I remember the whole thing. There was no, I wasn't knocked out or anything like that. No, I remember it all. It's not even... You know, I wouldn't even describe. It's not something that, you know, you hear people saying they have nightmares, and that, you know, it's not something. It wasn't traumatic, or, you know, I remember the whole hospital experience, everything. But I suppose there's a certain part of your brain, naturally you kind of put that behind you, and if you want to move forward, and keep going, you just feel. You put that to the back of your head.
And what actually happened on the day itself? Did you land under a horse?
No, it was a simple enough fall. The main thing would have been the ground was at Torella. It's right beside the beach. Just firm ground, and just got a bad fall. Look, this injury has happened to people. I met people in hospital and they tripped going through their front door and fell, you know, banged their head. And it's as simple as that. You know, this injury can happen. It can happen to anybody at any stage doing the simplest of tasks. If anything, it happened to me doing something that I would never have changed. Had it have happened doing something stupid on a night out or something like that, I would have found that a lot more difficult to come to terms with.
Yeah, no doubt. The initial prognosis was pretty horrific, but actually you did get some significant movement back as time went on, so your body healed a little bit.
It did, yeah. A spinal injury is extremely complex, and it can be, you know, no two can be compared. Millimeters can make such a difference. Like for example, I can wiggle all my toes, and that's the, as far as signals go, that's the furthest away, and that just doesn't make sense. And there's, you know, there's parts of my legs there that, like for example, with my physios there, I would be working away with all the time, and we're slowly making small gains, even now that we're well past the period of time where you're maybe not supposed to see any gains, you know. So it's still all going the right direction, you know.
Yeah, because I can only imagine that sometimes that must be infuriating. Like, well, why can I still be making progress? This progress can't stop. And then why am I not making more progress? And then actually I'm still making progress. That's pretty good. So that's a bit of a roller coaster, I suspect.
It is, yeah. Yeah, it is. And the other thing, I suppose, I tried to set up at the start, you know, I was happy enough to dedicate every single day to physio and just keeping my head down, and the ultimate goal of basically beating it and walking again. And I'll never give up on that, but at the same time it was very important to structure things that it fitted in. You have to live your life, you know. You have to, there's things you have to get on with. You know, you have to live your life and try and fit all these other things in around that, you know. And I think at the minute there, I have a nice balance that way.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a very traumatic thing to go through, but that you've found an accommodation and a support system that really works for you, with the hope that at some point in the future you can continue to get better.
Yeah, well, that, you know, there's so many good things going on medically and scientifically, that my idea is continue with my maintenance program, staying in good shape, staying in the best shape possible. That, you know, we just don't know. We don't know what's around the corner, in terms of treatments. I don't ever see, you know, that there's going to be a pill you take that all of a sudden you're 100% again. But I do see the day where there'll be treatments that can improve things vastly, you know, for people with an injury like this.
And the racing community seems to be good as well when you're in difficulty, to rally around people and to look after people who obviously could do with a bit of help. And I suppose it's something it can be proud of.
Absolutely brilliant. You know, I've said in a couple of things that I don't think there's any other sport in the world that looks after people as well as racing does. And, you know, I was 19, I had 40 or 50 rides, you know. I wasn't a jockey, you know. I was right at the bottom of the scale, and you know, I was looked after exactly, you know, every bit as well as somebody who had been riding for years and was at the other end of the scale, you know.
Yeah, that was the strange thing. John Thomas was on the cusp of retirement, and John Joe was starting off, and it was interesting the way it happened like that. But your accent. One thing I am interested in. People will quickly realise that you're from the north. But how much of a worry is Brexit up there now in terms of just the business of racing and how this is going to impact the small number of people in Northern Ireland who are involved in horses?
To be honest, is something. I've sort of tried to stay. I'll be honest. I don't think anybody knows. But I certainly don't. I've heard a couple of scary things just about the border and you know what way things is going to work, moving animals up and down. But you know, hopefully there's nothing there that's going to, you know, cause too much interruption. Or make things any more difficult for people, you know.
Are you racing background yourself?
Yeah. My dad was a point-to-point jockey. My uncle, my mum, my granda, they were all sort of steeped in racing. So I started off when I was younger. I'd done a lot of show jumping, but I was always probably going to go the racing direction, you know.
Well, listen, John, it's been great hearing your story and best of luck with the pinhook. And it sounds like whether or not it's beginner's luck or maybe you've got an eye for it. Thanks very much for talking to us and best of luck with everything.
Thanks very much, Ben. Thanks for having me. Cheers.
It's John Joe Bright there giving us his fairly remarkable story. This is Friday Night Racing. It's brought to you by goracing.ie. Now, the Tote Irish Injured Jockeys charity was topped up by €340, it says here, after Ridwin. Have I got the right name?
Ryden. It's Welsh, I think, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ryden, maybe? Ridwin?
There was a W there. Anyway, yeah. Ran out an easy and well-punted winner last Saturday evening at Limerick, it says here. Did you pick this?
I did, yeah.
Oh, wow, okay. Yeah. The fund now stands at an impressive €5,329.44. It's Ulster Derby Day at Down Royal tomorrow, and Sunday's action is going to come from Tipperary. In the UK, the curtain obviously is going to come down on what's been a fantastic week at Royal Ascot. The highlight on the card will be the Group 1 Diamond Jubilee Stakes. That one's due off at 4:20. Remember, you can enjoy the Tote versus SP best price guarantee on all Irish racing and Royal Ascot this weekend. Check out thetote.com for details. What have you gone for this week, Johnny?
Yeah, it's obviously the curtain, as you say, brought down on Royal Ascot. The strange thing about the week has been the grounds. They have had proper soft ground, which has involved like deluges and deluges of rain, and I keep going on about this, but the more erratic weather we get, the less unusual it is, I suppose. But it won't be a big problem for I Am Superman. Now, he runs for Michael O'Callaghan, who was our guest in your stead last week. He was quite hopeful about this horse, who started off in handicaps at the start of the season. He runs in the Jersey Stakes at 3:05. I'm going to give him as a sporting selection in the 3:05. That's the Jersey Stakes at Royal Ascot. The other two races we should talk about, obviously the Hardwick Stakes, Defoe, who you may remember David Jennings was very sweet on the last time he ran, winning the Coronation. He's taken on Southern France. I think Southern France will go very well there. Latidar in the race as well, definitely very interesting. And then we have the big race, which is the Commonwealth Cup. The
Diamond Jubilee.
The big sprint. Commonwealth Cup obviously run yesterday. The Diamond Jubilee is interesting because what happens with Royal Ascot is you do get these horses running twice in the week, including Blue Point, who was obviously impressive earlier in the week, and he likes this track as well. He just looks in great nicky.
How is it they can produce great form 2 days apart?
It's going to be 4 days, but he beat Batash, who basically he probably just has a bit too much stamina for even over 5 furlongs. But I'd imagine as a trainer, you'd probably just do nothing with them. They run flat out for a minute, and then you'd produce them 4 days later. And I remember Choisir running this race and running in both races, possibly Oasis Dream as well back in the day. So it's a nice aspect of the week, but Blue Point should take a bit of beating as well. And
will that not just tell at the end? Well, that's a 6 furlongs.
He doesn't mind 6 furlongs at all, but I don't know. One thing about running a horse twice in succession is at least you know the horse is going into the race in proven form. So that takes one of them imponderables away.
Likes the track.
Likes the track, yeah. And is able to deal with the hurly-burly and the atmosphere, because a lot of horses completely boil over with all the noise and like whatever amount of 1,000 people are there. Like, Galway's coming up at the end of next month, and it wouldn't be uncommon for Tony Martin had a horse who won 3 times in Galway not that long ago, and like there'll be horses running multiple times in Galway, and you know, again with Galway, if you like the track, sure, why not go again?
Well, the prize money is amazing. It's 340 grand sterling. So, like, yeah, I mean, if you've got a chance, I suspect the owners of Blue Point,
they're not short of a few bob.
Yeah, it's fine, but like, you know,
it's just, well, it's also a lot, very prestigious to win twice in a week and to win, to do the double in that race, and you know, the sprint of that nature, really, really exciting to watch, the pinnacle really of flat racing, to watch horses go as fast as that.
Okay, so the flat season, what are we at, the 20th of June? We still obviously have some the main flat races in Ireland to come, but is this the kind of high water mark in England? Is everything slightly...
Yeah, it is the pinnacle. They'll have their Champions weekend later on at Ascot. I should mention Labravido as well in that race, Aidan O'Brien. I definitely wouldn't rule him out at a big prize, because he has tried him over a mile the last twice, and his French form was over shorter. I think he could definitely benefit from dropping back in trip. Wouldn't oppose a saver on him. But we're coming into Irish Derby weekend. It's going to be a three-day festival, slightly rejigged time frame this year in terms of the timing of the races, and then obviously the Irish calendar will have the Oaks, but we'll be counting down through Galway into Listowel and the Champions weekend, which is really the big 2 days of Irish racing on the flat.
Yeah, but from an English perspective, this is as good as it gets, really.
Yeah, well, like, obviously you could say the Derby's the best race, but Royal Ascot is the week. It's kind of like the Cheltenham of the flat, really.
Alright, Johnny, good stuff, thanks very much for that.
Not at all, Ger.
Another Friday Night Racing is in the books for you. If you have any comments for us, you can hit us up at Off The Ball on Twitter. Obviously on a Friday afternoon we stream this live on Facebook, YouTube and Twitter. The best place to get us these days is actually on offtheball.com, and then of course we're also live on the radio then on a Friday evening from just after 8 o'clock. Friday Night Racing brought to you by goracing.ie.
Friday Night Racing
on Off The Ball,
and they're off.
Brought to you by Go Racing. Plan your day at the races at goracing.ie.